Zambales and a few other committee members are out in the hallway. When they come in, I'll call the meeting to order. Until that time, we'll be holding, we'll just call this a work session. We'll call this work session to order. I'd like to start taking testimony from around the state on SB 211 or SB 461. I'd like to go to Cordova at this time. Mr. Ed, and I'm sorry, sir, I can't pronounce your last name. So it's Zeine?
Yes,
Zeine. Okay, sir, could you just state, that's good, if you could just state your name and who you're with for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Okay, this is Ed Zeine. I'm the minister of the hospital in Cordova, Alaska. I'd like to testify first on Senate Bill 461. Cordova Community Hospital is a small rural facility, and although the hospital has never had a malpractice since, its malpractice premium has increased $47,000 since 1985. We feel that Senate Bill 461, if it does not pass, will have the end result of increasing the premium for the hospital again this year by a tremendous amount of funds. We feel that the hospital should be negligent for their wrongs that they commit, and the court would have in the past so prosecuted. Now we have added, since the Jackson Powers case, another level of liability against the hospital, which in my belief is wrong, and it is causing much problems throughout the state between the hospitals and the physicians, and it has nothing to do with the type of care that's actually provided to the patient. I would urge all of the members of the Senate, the House, to pass Bill Senate Bill 461 into law. On Senate Bill 211 on tort reform, I believe tort reform is necessary in Alaska to avoid the continuing escalation of the malpractice premiums. The Medical Indemnity Corporation of Alaska informs us that passing of Senate Bill 211 would have a positive effect by limiting certain judgments and avoid the deep pocket problem that hospitals and physicians are presently suffering under. Health facilities must carry some form of malpractice insurance, and there's no reason those businesses that carry malpractice insurance should be liable for negligent acts of others. Restrictions on joint and several liability, the protection of voluntary boards, elimination of Rule 82, surcharge, and among others, in enforcing and controlling the malpractice insurance premium. I urge you to pass Senate Bill 211. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Can we go on to Travis Yarbrough, and then we'll take Mara Kohler, Cordova.
Yes, Travis Yarbrough, Cordova Health Services. I also urge you to pass this House Bill 461. It's one of the basic reasons. I have reservations even volunteering my time to serve on the board. We have these things presented to us because it reaches right into the court as far as liability, and as I feel that sooner or later it might be a case of having problems with getting people served on this person. It's just can't understand how this such a thing could happen in areas where these lawsuits are being reported against the hospitals. They're not the negligent party. Also, House Bill 211, I urge you to pass that, as it will help in more ways than just on our malpractice public business management construction, and our tort reform reaches into all facets of our community. So I request that you pass that bill also. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Okay, Mira Kohler, Cordova.
Yes, my name is Mira Kohler. I apologize for bending your ear again today. I testified briefly yesterday. At the time, I was under the impression we were only taking testimony in 211, so I withheld my 461 testimony, which I would like to offer to you now. I'm a member of the Cordova City Council and have been a member of the Cordova Health Services Advisory Board since 1982. In the last 6 years, I have witnessed the changes in state regulatory practices that have continuously imposed greater operating and financial restraints on our small hospital. In 1984, we were forced to begin construction of a hospital because our 30-year-old structure no longer met regulations. The state provided $9 of the $10 million construction costs, and the rest was local participation. We are presently caught in the middle of an argument with the state's Medicaid Rate Commission, contend that the costs of small facilities like ours are too high, notwithstanding the fact that these higher costs are necessitated by standards and regulations imposed by another branch of the same state department. Add to this the burden of malpractice insurance that goes up each year in major leaps and bounds. Between 1985 and this year, our premiums have tripled from $24,000 to well over $70,000. 2 years ago, our three-man medical clinic chose to drop their malpractice insurance, thereby losing over 15 years of continuous malpractice insurance coverage because their premium was almost tripling from $24,000 to $65,000 in one single year. Credova has never had a malpractice suit. Our doctors are good, conscientious practitioners who want to deliver babies for and take care of our 2,500 residents. The malpractice insurance premium increase alone would have cost every family having a baby here last year an additional $1,200. Last year, we paid a premium surcharge at the hospital to cover for the fact that we had uninsured physicians practicing there. This year, with the outcome of the Jackson Powers case, we know that surcharge will be higher, but we don't know by how much yet. The statistics indicate that 90% of all malpractice suits originate in the hospital. The hospital picks up the tab. In the Jackson Powers case, even though it was clear that the case was one of doctor neglect, not hospital neglect, the case against the physicians was dropped, and the hospital got assessed the $1.7 million in damages and costs. If this SB 461 is not passed, and hospitals are forced to pay the burden of non-employees' actions, they are sealing the fate of small rural hospitals like ours. We may as well close the doors of our beautiful $10 million facility because we won't be able to pay the insurance bill. I urge you in the strongest possible way to pass this legislation into law this year. Please don't cripple the rural Alaska healthcare delivery system. We deserve medical attention in Credova just as much as anywhere else in Alaska. Thank you for this opportunity to present my testimony.
Okay, thank you, ma'am. At this time, we do have our committee here, so I'd like to call the meeting to order. It's the House Labor and Commerce Committee meeting. It's, I'm losing track of the dates. What is today? The 27th of April. And present is Vice Chairman Kopanen, Representative Boucher, Representative Menard, Representative Furness, Representative Davidson, Representative Ellis, and myself, Chairman Donnelly. And the first witness I'm going to call is the Director of the Division of Insurance, Paul Roller. Mr. Roller, would you like to join us here?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Well, we are on teleconference now, so we'll use your mic.
My name is Paul Roller. I'm Director of Insurance, State of Alaska. One reason why I'm testifying today is because I'm a little bit confused as to some of the provisions in the bill. Specifically, Section 12, Subsection 8, there's an additional recording requirement.
Okay. Mr. Roller, we are taking testimony on both 211 and 461 today, so I think you're referring to 211.
Yes, I am. Okay. Sorry, Mr. Chairman. Under Section 8, the Division of Insurance is to conduct an analysis of medical malpractice insurance rate changes occurring as a result of court decisions in the state involving personal injury or death. The difficulty I have here is that I'm uncertain as to whether that means decisions, meaning appellate decisions, where there have been law changes, or whether we're talking about court decisions resulting in judgments. The division would not be in a position to really analyze a change in law and resulting impact that it would have on the rates without going beyond some of the expertise that's available to the division. We intend to file an amended fiscal note on this particular section. The other difficulty that I have is this, is that it's obvious that judgments do add to rates. But the question is the judgments themselves that are the driving force? And I'd like to give a couple of examples, and I am going to make my remarks brief tonight. One thing Senator Fakes said yesterday is that she was interested in hard info, and I think we all are. Now, one of the problems is the judgments are just gross indicators of whether a rate is going to go up. There may be something else driving that other than the judgment itself. and I'd like to give you an example. Recently, there's been a $2 million judgment, and I won't use the name of the case, but I will state that I asked of the insurance entity whether there had been any settlement offers, and I was told there hadn't been. I asked why, and I was told that the reason being is that the defense lawyer said they were going to win. Now, if we have 10 cases that were going to settle for $100,000, and in each and every instance the defense attorney advised the person that they were defending to go ahead and try it, and they resulted in $2 million verdicts, is it judgments that are driving the rate, or is it incompetent defense attorneys that should have taken reasonable settlement offers? Another example is part of the judgments of pretrial interest. Does the pretrial interest accrue just naturally, or is it a result of a clogged court system? Are pretrial interest costs also an indicator of excessive defense delays? And so my point here today is that if we were to do analysis of just judgments alone, it could be very misleading if we're in a search for hard facts. On to Section 14, which I refer to in our fiscal notice, Section 12, we've estimated that a closed case study, would cost approximately $150,000. I just bring that point up because I think it is a significant amount of money. The other minor point that I had is that under Section 14.2a, the word dramatic liability insurance rate increases is used. The word dramatic, I think, doesn't add very much. If somebody would use the word significant, which statistically is a 5% increase or more, it's more understandable. I just bring out that as more of a housekeeping point, but I think the word significant or some other word that we can quantify would be far easier. And with that, I have no other testimony. And thank you.
Thank you, sir. Are there any questions for the director? Thank you very much.
Yes.
Representative Boucher.
One of the things having...
Representative Boucher, we're on teleconference.
Yeah, I'll hear you. Thank you. One of the things that I've learned listening to this now, this is going into the fourth year on it, on labor and commerce, listening to the pros and cons of it. One of the things that was presented was the opportunity to gather information and evaluate. What role do you believe, has the department been doing anything in this ongoing process to gather that information together?
Well, in the area of medical malpractice, we rely on the rate filings. But one of the difficulties that I have, Representative Boucher, is that the rate filings provide us with gross numbers that really don't give the kind of information that you folks need. If I could use just one example, insurance companies report adjusting expenses. That's their generic term. And under generic expenses are both what claims adjusters do for the company, whether inside the company or outside the company, as well as defense fees. Now, there's been a lot of discussion as to attorney's fees, and they usually focus in on plaintiff's attorney's fees. And we can usually find out what plaintiff's attorney's fees because they're either part of the judgment. If not, maybe you can go behind that and find out that there's a contingency agreement. We would not have that information, but usually that could be found out. In the instance of insurance companies, and I've asked, I said, can you break out for me what the defense costs are? And they tell me they cannot because they lump it all together under claim adjustment expenses. Now, the little information that we have from national publications is that in the civil arena, the defense costs are actually greater than the plaintiff's attorneys. And yet we very seldom hear that spoken in a public forum. Now, we would need to do what's being requested of us in Section 14 is actually go into the claims files themselves and break out the information that we would feel was pertinent and significant, and not use the way many of the insurance companies are lumping the expenses together. As I use the claims adjustment expenses, well, it's important for our purposes to know, not for the Division of Insurance, but for the purpose of the legislature, to know, for example, whether defense costs are excessive throughout in Alaska as compared to the rest of the country. We have no way of knowing that. Maybe our defense costs are within the norm. Maybe they're not. Maybe they're twice as much. We simply do not know that. We can lump it together and compare claims adjustment expenses, but there's no real way of comparing comparing the two.
Through the chair, just walk me through and explain, if it can be done, the information that you would need to build a database. There's all types of them that could be built, that if we were to say, well, how many claims have been paid in the state of Alaska? And breaking out the various cases, what do you need? Is it available?
Well, one of the difficulties is the state, for statistical purposes, is usually too small to generate statistically reliable numbers. We see that in the area of health costs. We're always relying on national data. Mm-hmm. And then the term is used as that Alaska windage is applied to those numbers.
Alaska what?
Windage.
What's windage?
It's an Alaska adjustment based on best estimates and allegedly sound judgment.
Go over that once again.
Okay. I'll use the example workers' compensation. Okay. There's a National Rating Bureau, the NCCI. They collect data from 700 different insurance companies. And they will evaluate, for example, the workers' comp bill on loss development throughout the country and various kinds of injuries. The next step is after they give us their best estimate, if you will, of what rates should be. There's an Alaska Rate and Classification Committee that meets and is composed of local insurance companies and companies doing business in the state. And they look at those numbers and they look at the proposed legislation, and then they apply what's called this Alaska windage. And they say, well, we're looking at the national data, but in Alaska there are a little bit different circumstances. Perhaps there are more back claims, whatever. Maybe, a particular example is with the out-of-state residents collecting workers' compensation benefits. And they'll say, well, we know from experience that there are a great number of people collecting Alaska benefits, and so maybe we should adjust the rate upwardly or downwardly. And that's kind of a unique situation to the state of Alaska. And that's what they claim is Alaska windage. But in all these areas, whether it's health costs or otherwise, we have real problems getting a large enough statistical base to apply what's called the law of large numbers. And we can see it with MICA, for example. There's a dispute right now going on between the actuaries as to what the premium should be, what the loss reserving based on the past history has been. And the problem simply is that, number one, there isn't a sufficient period of time that MICA has been in existence. And secondly, the number of doctors is very, very small. And in order to get reliable numbers, the sampling size is going to have to increase. And what's happened with the actuaries, they've chosen states like California and said, well, California's loss record is such. And they look at that and they compare it to what they think is happening in Alaska and they come up with something in between. There's a lot of words spoken that insurance is an exact science, and it is not. It's more of an art.
Representative Boucher, we're going to run out of teleconference time.
I guess, to me, the key, Mr. Rowe, back for some more questions. And I guess one of the messages I would want to leave with Paul was, you know, we just been through this in workers' comp. What's the hard data? And I think Jackie McClintock there indicated the information wasn't there or it wasn't being reported. It's extremely difficult to make good, intelligent decisions without the hard data. You end up with the political push and pull and the emotionalism. If there's anything that we can do here as a body, I think one of the first things that has to be developed is to make good, intelligent decisions on complex issues such as tort reform, workers' comp, which are mind-boggling in themselves. We need, if possible, the good data. I don't think we can just rely on California. We passed a bill the other day, Mr. Chairman, that simply says we can't determine our economy based on national economy or national employment. And so we've established hopefully a system of Alaska economic indicators. I would hope that it is possible to do that. I know I've been listening to it for 4 years, and it's still, I'm more caught up in the emotionalism, and I'm a person, I want to know hard numbers.
Well, Representative Boucher, we're putting some more, the House has has made a priority at Division of Insurance, although the Senate has not funded their budget sufficiently to do that job. The House has, hopefully that will make it through the budget cuts. Okay. Ms. Rolla, thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
And appreciate you being here. I may have you back to answer some more questions. I'd like to call Sherry Gull at this time in Juneau, and then after Ms. Gull's testimony, I'd like to go to Allison Horton in Anchorage, and after that, Kathy Kane in Anchorage.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Sherry Gull, and I'm here representing the Alaska Women's Lobby. And we have... we have serious concerns about this legislation, which seeks to further limit compensation to injured victims. And specifically, I'm concerned about the section that limits, that lowers the cap on the non-economic damages to $100,000. I think that this section, you'll find, will further discrimination against non-wage earners, and by that I mean homemakers, children, and senior citizens, because those are people who have no measurable economic value. I know that Dr. McGuire testified yesterday that one could translate the value of a person who doesn't have a W-2 form into an economic number, and then it could be used as an economic damage, but I would just say that I feel that the unpaid work that women do in the home has been undervalued consistently in society and continues to be. And it seems to me that it would be very difficult then for that person's value to be translated into economic terms. And beyond that, I feel that the non-economic damages are meant to compensate for some of those things that people value very highly but don't necessarily have a price tag attached to them. And I would give you a for instance of if a young mother, for instance, was injured in some way that where another party was at fault and lost the use of her arms, that using Dr. McGuire's theory, one might say that the necessary child care costs that have become necessary because of her injury might they might be able to pay for her child care costs, but how would they be able to translate the loss that she would have in never being able to hold her child in her arms again? I think that, you know, these are the kinds of things that pain and suffering and non-economic damages are about, placing a value on things that don't have a price tag. This person, perhaps, who wasn't working outside of the home but had planned to return to the workforce after her child became a school age and now might not be able to, how will we compensate her for the foreclosure of her future opportunities? And in addition, of course, I think there are things like infertility and disfigurement that can't really be measured in strictly economic terms. So I think that the $100,000 cap that's set in the committee substitute that's before you is far too low. And I'd say that the record will show that, in fact, the Senate Finance Committee lowered that number to $100,000 because they believed that the House would find that number to be too low and would raise it, and they felt that if they left it at 250, the way it was in the original Senate version, then it would be raised by the House to a number that was higher than they wanted.
But do they do things like that?
It was on the record, so I think I can say that. In any case, I feel that lowering the cap from the $500,000 that's in law now was something that was put in law when the last legislative attempt at tort reform took place, and they made that cap on non-economic damages in the first place, and I feel that that cap is sufficiently low, and I would not like to see it lowered further. Women's Lobby feels that. A second section that concerns us is the section on periodic payments. Currently, it seems that that choice of whether or not a person will be paid in periodic payments or a lump sum is the choice of the injured party, has the option. And the changes in this legislation would take that option away from the injured party and give it to the insurance companies. And I think that when a person's ability to earn a living has been taken away from them, one of the options that is available to them would be to take their settlement and to become an investor, to invest their money and to live off the interest of their money. And this would take away that option from them and allow the insurance companies to continue to earn interest on the money as they then paid it out in small portions to the victim. And the other day, Peggy Bergen from the Older Alaskans Commission also expressed concern about senior citizens, about this section in so far as what happens if a person dies before their full settlement is paid. And we share those same concerns. We do believe that the choice about whether or not it should be a lump sum payment or periodic payment should remain with the injured person. The third section that causes some concern is the court rule change that prohibits the costs of the attorney fees going to the prevailing party. And that's simply because we feel it will unnecessarily have an unnecessarily negative effect on poor persons who are injured. We think that the restrictions that were imposed by the legislature a couple of years ago in tort reform have not yet provided any relief from the escalating rates. And we don't believe that the escalating rates are actually have been caused by the injured parties or the verdicts that were reached in their behalf. And in fact, from our reading, we believe that the jury verdicts are not rising faster than the health care index and the consumer price index, but are just keeping pace with inflation. And last year, and I don't know more about this than what I read in the newspaper, a group called Jury Verdict Research Incorporated did a state survey in Alaska and found that the jury awards in Alaska actually averaged 6% less than the national norms. And we sort of feel that if the high jury verdicts were the reason for the escalating rates, that at some point we would have seen a negative impact on profitability of the insurance companies. And I don't think that this has been the case, and I have not heard testimony to that over the course of this bill. I have read that the Insurance Services Office of the federal government, which advises carriers on rates, say that profits, operating profits have actually, and this was last year, tripled in the first 9 months of that year as compared to the same period of time of the previous year. And finally, I would just express my concern about your feeling that the public has a real need for tort reform based on the Dittman survey. Because when I read the Dittman survey, it seemed that the first question they asked the people who were polled was, have you ever heard of tort reform? And 60% of the people answered no. And then they proceeded to ask them a bunch of questions about joint and several liability. And these people who didn't know what tort reform was, didn't even know it had to do with lawsuits, then answered questions. And I just think that when you weigh the results of that poll, you have to do it in light of the fact that the people were given all of their information about tort reform during that interview with the pollster. And that's all. We just don't think that there is really tremendous public support for a need for passage of this legislation. And thank you for your consideration.
Okay, thank you for your testimony. Hopefully we don't have questions here. All right, I'd like to go back to Anchorage. Start with Allison Horton there in Anchorage and then go to Kathy Kane.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Allison Horton. I am Deputy Director of the Alaska Academy of Trial Lawyers. I am not a lawyer. I am an advocate for health and safety issues and an administrator. I'm here in opposition to SB 211 and SB 461. I listened to the teleconference portion of the hearing on these bills yesterday and want to respond to a couple of recurring general themes. We hear a great deal about tort reform seeking to redress liability problems, not insurance problems. But this raises the question as to what exactly the liability problems are. After all, liability is really just another word for responsibility, and with responsibility comes accountability. A legislator's constituents demand accountability. A homeowner demands accountability from the plumber who's in to do repairs. You heard extensive testimony from the healthcare and engineering professions yesterday. Clearly, society should expect high standards of accountability in professions whose performance have great impact on the health and safety of the public. It would be nice if it weren't necessary, but unfortunately, we have to have incentives in place in order to promote acceptable standards of safety. creating those incentives is an important part of what our criminal justice system is about. Our society cannot afford to operate in a climate where no one wants to or has an obligation to take responsibility for their actions. This legislature has seen a deluge of liability immunity bills catering to particular interest groups. SB 461, I have to say, is a case in point. Hospitals do not apparently want to be held responsible for the work that is performed within their walls. We have to ask what exactly the incentives would be then for them to review the professional histories and performance records adequately for their medical and healthcare professionals. Going back to SB 211, one of the fairness issues of particular concern is the $100,000 cap on non-economic damages. Such a cap on pain and suffering damages only hurts those who have been hurt in the worst ways and who most need compensation. The big losers are the victims of devastating injuries such as brain damage or permanently crippling malpractice. In fact, even the nationally renowned conservative think tank, the Heritage Foundation, has stated that the $100,000 cap is, quote, unrealistically low. There is absolutely no evidence anywhere in the United States that caps or other tort reform strategies are usefully reducing insurance rates. In Florida, Washington, Colorado, and Maryland, for instance, they have all been faced with insurance industry rate increases and announcements of policy cancellations and coverage reductions after they had acquiesced to pressure and adopted tort changes. The explanation for runaway insurance rates, which is gradually emerging, is turning out to be a very different one. The lawsuit filed last month by 9 states against dozens of insurance companies and reinsurers charges the companies with conspiracy to create an insurance crisis. The suit is the result of a 2-year nationwide and international investigation during which witnesses were interviewed and over 100,000 documentary evidence was collected. This is expected to be the largest antitrust case in U.S. history. The states which have sued and others considering joining the suit have undertaken this massive case because their research has identified an enormous problem of evaporating insurance availability and skyrocketing rates, which needs to be corrected on behalf of local governments and in the interests of citizens, nonprofit organizations, individual businesses, and professionals in those states. Frankly, I have to say that I'm surprised the interests represented by the Citizens Coalition for Tort Reform haven't chosen to take a strong position in support of the state's participation in the suit if they are truly interested in remedying the inequities in cost and availability of insurance. I'd like to close with comments on one last provision, simply reinforcing Paul Roller's comments regarding reporting requirements, and would point to an analogy when you're simply looking at the court award relationship to raising rates, that you're really looking at something analogous to the fable about the three blind men and the elephant. And if we're going to end up with a complete picture of what's really going on with insurance problems, we have to include more than court awards in our reporting requirements. I urge this committee to look for the full picture, and thank you for giving me the time to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Horton. Kathy Kane there in Anchorage, and after Ms. Kane, Frank Thomas Mears.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Boucher, we're on teleconference.
Alice, this Representative Boucher, I would appreciate you sending me the copy of the article that you quoted out of the Heritage Fund, if you would please, via the Chairman, Representative Donville.
My name is Kathy Kane. I'm employed at Providence Hospital in Anchorage. I don't have a lot of technical terms for you. I'm concerned about the future of healthcare in Alaska. I'm a long-term resident. I've been here 14 and a half years and have no intention of moving. I'm worried that if we continue the current trend towards pressing the hospitals for liability, that the healthcare costs will go so out of sight that people aren't going to be able to afford good or conscientious healthcare. Since I've been at Providence, I've always been impressed with the qualities of healthcare and the commitment of the people and the hospital towards good, cost-effective health care for the people of Alaska. I don't feel that it's fair to lay the liability at the door of the hospital for people who are not employed by the hospital. I urge you to pass Senate Bills 211 and 461. I feel they're extremely important to the future of people in Alaska. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Can we move on to Frank Thomas Mears? I'm sorry, that's the way it appears on my list here. If I'm getting your name wrong, I apologize. And then after that, we have Judy Sharp.
Yeah, my name is Frank Thomas Mears. I am the chapter secretary of the American Subcontractors Association. I am speaking as their representative tonight. Our words to the Labor and Commerce Committee are short. We support Senate Bill 211. We also support Senate Bill 461. We believe there are similar issues. Get on with it. Hold your hearings, but get that bill out and get it moving through the committee process. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mears. I'd like to remind you the bill was in the Senate for over a year. Move on to Judy Sharp, and then after that, Nelson Franklin.
My name is Judy Sharp. I have lived in Alaska for 19 years. I've spent 15 years working in the healthcare setting as a medical social worker and department director. I'm also self-employed, owning a flying fishing lodge. I'm here to strongly testify for passage of both 211 and 461. In the 15 years that I've been in healthcare, I have seen a dramatic change in the climate, in the stresses on the physician-patient relationships, and in the allocation of resources to help meet unmet patient needs. These reforms are necessary to help rein in spiraling healthcare costs. Over the past 5 years, I have seen funding and resources to assist patients continue to be cut or totally eliminated. I've had to work directly with individuals who find themselves without coverage for medical care when sudden major illness hits. They need extensive ongoing medical care to live, and the programs that have helped them cover these costs have been cut back or eliminated. At the same time, I see millions of dollars being spent by the legal system as lawyers battle lawyers or on gigantic malpractice premiums. I think that reason has to prevail. We need to reassess our priorities, and I urge passage of 211 and 461.
Thank you, ma'am. Can we move on to Nelson Franklin and then Robert Fitz?
Thank you, Chairman Donnelly. My name is Nelson Franklin. I'm a registered civil engineer in the state of Alaska, and I'm a principal in the firm of Franklin & Allen Incorporated. The high cost and lack of availability of insurance in the Alaskan business community has added to the difficulty of doing business during these hard economic times. I urge you to support Senate Bill 211 to move it out of committee. Passage of this bill this year will give a needed bit of moral support to the business community. Not passing this bill reinforces the lack of support of the business community and encourages the rash of unjustified litigation we are experiencing. Our existing tort laws leave a sense of unpredictability in our court system. Renew the fairness and predictability by passing Senate Bill 211. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, sir. We'll move on to Robert Fitz, and then after that, Denton Mays.
I'm Father Robert Fitz. I'm a Jesuit priest, a hospital chaplain, director of the Department of Pastoral Care. I've been in Alaska for 5 years and intend to stay. I have been involved in hospital work in three different states and Alaska. And I just would like to preach that there be action taken on Senate Bill 461 and Senate Bill 211. I don't want to especially address those particular bills, but I can only tell you that the climate in the hospitals in this state and among the medical professions is very volatile. There are an awful lot of tensions, an awful lot of pressures, and I find it absolutely impossible to believe that the people of Alaska are served well when people are living in fear, trepidation because of lawsuits, because of the types of restraints that are put on payments and all the rest. People's livelihoods are involved in all this, and it's really imperative that the state direct their attention to what is going on and realize that something has to be done to bring redress and bring relief from all of this. Thank you.
Thank you, Father. If you could move on to Denton Mays and then Shirley Frazier.
Thank you. I'm Denton Mays. I've been in Alaska since 1976. I would like to offer testimony in favor of the urgent passage of the House versions of Senate Bills 211 and 461. This issue is basically a question of money. As we think about these bills, we need to keep that in mind. As a physician, I am shocked at industry projections that malpractice insurance premiums will triple by 1990. Even though I have never been sued for malpractice, my insurance premiums have increased every year. There is absolutely no question that the cost of all types of liability insurance is high and getting higher. So it is important to ask, who pays for the cost of this insurance? The answer is simple. You do, we all do. And the sad truth is that this cost is a heavy burden on those who least have the ability to pay for it. The poor, the senior citizens on fixed income, and those who are temporarily out of work. The high cost of liability insurance is felt in two ways. First, in the direct increases in the cost of goods and services. The second is the loss of certain services entirely. It's important to look at both of these areas. Large companies such as Cars or Sears, as well as most doctors and lawyers, can simply pass these increases in insurance costs along to the customer as higher costs for their product. Although I have not increased my professional fees in over 4 years, they will soon come when I have to raise them. The price of literally everything we buy is being increased by the cost of liability insurance. Most of you who are in the legislature and me also do not have to worry about a 10% increase in your cost of living. But many of our fellow Alaskans are having hard times now. Who speaks for them? They cannot afford the inflation caused by constant increases in insurance costs. Even more important than the steady increase in the cost of goods and services is the complete loss of some types of services entirely. Daycare centers cannot pass the increased cost along to poor mothers, so there are fewer daycare centers. Small hospitals and clinics in rural Alaska cannot pass their costs along to the limited populations that they serve, so they go out of business. Then there are fewer local hospitals and clinics. Family doctors in rural Alaska cannot pass along their increased costs, so they have to stop delivering babies. The mothers then have to come to Anchorage to have their babies. The current system is crazy. Insurance costs will continue to increase until we get meaningful tort reform in Alaska. That's a fact. Alaskans cannot afford the cost of the current tort system. That's a fact. We need tort reform now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mays. Let's go on to Shirley. You're up next after Shirley Frazier.
Hi, my name is Shirley Frazier. I'm a medical doctor who has lived and practiced in Alaska since 1963, first in public health service, now as a private practitioner. I'm testifying very strongly in favor of Hospital Bill 211 and 461 because I feel that these court reforms that we have, we're going to have such terrible, weighty burdens of insurance on hospitals. No longer going to be able to replace old equipment, improve their equipment, hire sufficient nurses, and generally health care will be significantly impaired in rural Alaska and even here in the larger cities. The lawyers who oppose this are not disinterested. I want to illustrate this with an anecdote. There's a former mayor of Anchorage who sued and won an award of over $1 million. He never got one red penny. His award all went to legal fees and defense. The lawyer told him he had satisfaction of winning. I feel that that's one of the reasons the lawyers oppose this, because it's very profitable for them. Another anecdote is that often the awards are misspent. I know a child who's hit by a car. School paid, the crossing guard paid, and the driver paid. The family took the funds that were awarded for this child's medical care and invested in the laundromat, which failed. This child has since then been cared for on handicapped children's funds, not the funds which are supposed to go for her medical care. Lastly, we're going to watch very carefully which legislators vote for or against the passage of these bills. If you are really concerned about the health care in Alaska, you'll vote for them. Thank you.
Thank you, ma'am. Can we move on to the next witness? And then after that witness, we'll go to Stephanie Kelsey.
Yes, my name is Al Kamani. I reside in Anchorage, Alaska. And I am in support of the committee substitute for Senate Bill 211, accepting one portion. And that portion is on page number 6, section 14. The reason for that is that part only encompasses the insurance part of the study. I think that this committee has in its presence and has had it in there for approximately 2 months House Bill 514, and House Bill 513. These bills are intended to track the monies from the time they leave the insurance company, the total cost for defense, the total cost of the claim, punitive damages, the dates of filing, all of the itemization of costs. This is encompassed in HB 513. HB 514 requires the Bar Association and any plaintiff attorneys to report an itemization breakdown of the monies that they received. That is, how much they received in total, how much that they received in attorney fees, Rule 82, punitive damages, and all of that information. Gentlemen, these two bills should be looked at because it is one of the first good set of bills that have been introduced in the United States. These will give the legislature the ability to gather and analyze the information from both sides of the fence to measure the cost effectiveness to society. That is, the amount of dollars paid in and the amount that ends up victim gifts. You'll find out it's probably around 20-25%. There are too many middlemen involved. The consumers aren't happy and the victims aren't happy. These two bills tied on to the current bills you have will produce you the results you will need to monitor the insurance and the legal system virtually every year. I believe that your committee has had a companion bill stuck in it since last year. I urge you, in the interest of justice for all, and in the interest of being Alaskans first, politicians second, and party members third, to take a look at the total package. This needs to be done in the essence to be fair and justice for all. The coalition has supported publicly the pursuance of the actions against the insurance companies. If there's evidence there, proceed. We've publicly made that statement. We think that all environmental groups and all consumer groups, if they truly represent those entities, should support HB 513 and 14 tied in with the current bill we're talking about tonight. Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir. We had hearings on those bills last week or the week before that, I think. Stephanie Kiltzer and then Mary Pierce, Representative Furness, has some questions for you.
My name is Stephanie Kessler. I am the Executive Director of the Alaska for the Environment. A few things, specifics about the bill. We are glad to see that full joint federal liability has been added in for hazardous waste and environmental pollution problems. We know from studying this case and looking at what's happening in other states, there are other very legitimate exemptions also made that it seems the legislature hasn't made yet. I suggest that those be looked at very seriously. And as examples, some of those are also full joint and several liabilities for cases that involve parties who acted in concert, conspiracy, defective products, product liability. There's a whole slew of other things that are out there. If we have been able to adequately persuade this body that this should apply to environmental pollution cases, we realize that there are probably other very legitimate cases out there as well. Overall, our feeling is that the entire portion of the bill should be deleted except for section starting at 12, which looks at the reports that are required. And I'd like to get in a more general comment about what this bill attempts to do. I've been sitting and listening to these hearings for about four or five of them in total, and I must be honest, and I'm just speaking personally here, that it rips me apart to hear all these people who are very concerned about the public welfare. Hospitals, doctors, daycare owners, and a whole slew of businesses that are working to help society, believing that by changing state laws such as this, that it can actually alleviate their problems with insurance premiums. And I feel like I'm speaking more to the people behind me than to you, but I grew up in a world of rationality where you looked at facts and you looked at cause and effect. And if there's anything I can do in my testimony today, it would be to urge everyone looking at this issue to rationally look at it. The premise is that premiums are rising because of a litigation crisis in the courts. I affirm that that crisis does not exist. It has not been proven in the state of Alaska, and I testified about that earlier. And so that cause and effect premise first of all, has not been evidenced. Secondly, the premise that if you pass this kind of legislation, your premiums will drop has also not occurred in fact or reality. What has actually happened is that these have continued to climb in other states that have passed this these changes in tort reform. Next, actual fact, we have every reason to believe that as the press is beginning to find out, that the insurance companies have helped to create this crisis. And I'll just end with reading from an Anchorage Daily News article about this, indicating that 8 states have filed suit accusing dozens of insurance companies of conspiring to create this liability insurance crisis, making coverage unavailable or too costly for many governments and businesses. So I finish by saying we need to make these reports, we need to find the evidence and documentation for this mythical liability crisis. Ask any of these groups, have you been sued? Do you know of people in your business that have been sued? Is this a reality? And let's get to the heart of this problem and not lose our civil liabilities as the price tag for nothing. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Kessler. Mary Pierce, and after Mary Pierce, so we're going to go to Fairbanks for Wally Cox, George McKee, and then we're going to go to Petersburg for Tom Wood. Ms. Pierce, are you there?
Yes, I am, Chairman Donnelly.
Okay, Representative Furness has a question for you.
Thank you, Ms. Pierce. I appreciate you taking a few moments to respond to the question. As I recall, last week at a reception, it was brought to my attention that you are a member of the MICR board, as I recall. Is that correct?
No, Representative Donnelly. I was appointed by the governor and a member of the board for 4 years. I am now the executive director for MICA.
Oh, okay. That's even more pertinent than
mid-September of 1987.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. As I recall, earlier testimony from Cordova, the representative, at least on the staff of the hospital there, indicated the concern that their malpractice insurance would be increasing. Can you share with the committee, to the best of your knowledge, how many physicians or hospitals are insured on the MICR at this time?
We have approximately 315 physicians insured. That's about 60% of the physicians in the state. We also have 13 hospitals insured, which I think there are, that it would be inclusive of every hospital minus 6. And Humana in Anchorage, Providence Hospital in Anchorage, Charter North Hospital in Anchorage, Ketchikan Hospital, and Petersburg Hospital. Petersburg is uninsured. The other 5 are insured by, and Fairbanks Memorial also are insured by other entities other than MICA.
Okay, thank you. Next question. Senate Bill 211 would place a $100,000 limit on non-economic damage and change the collateral source rule. Will these changes reduce the insurance cost, in your opinion?
Well, Representative Furness, that is not necessarily an easy question to answer. We have done a fairly detailed study and may have some answers to that question, as well as answers to some of the facts and figures that that Paul Roller, the director, feels like we might be lacking. Specifically as to the non-economic damages, we have had settlements and verdicts that we knew what the non-economic, what the economic damages were, and can only assume that the difference between the economic damages and the total verdict are non-economic damages. It's hard for us to give you any facts and figures because so often the verdicts are not broken down so that we know what is economic and what is non-economic. As to the collateral source rule, we do have more information on that and would certainly have some fairly factual positive information that there would be a difference certainly in our loss experience if the collateral source rule, if there was given some weight to a collateral source.
Thank you for your response, Mr. Chairman. There's just two more questions briefly. Mrs. Pierce, has the number of lawsuits against doctors and hospitals increased? And if so, how many of those suits are over incidents in the hospital? You may recall that Senate Bill 461 is basically a result of the concerns in this area. Could you respond, please?
Representative Furness, actually, in the last couple of years, the number of claims and lawsuits has decreased in the state. The number of occurrences has increased in the state. The number and the value of awards has increased to the extreme. The study that we did looked at only those cases where there was a settlement or a verdict of over $100,000. We didn't look at any cases prior to 1984 because from MICA's inception in 1976 to 1983, we didn't have a verdict or a settlement over $100,000. So I can answer that the numbers may have decreased, but the value has certainly increased dramatically.
Now, if I may just seek a clarification there, you indicated now that the claims have decreased, but the occurrences have increased. As I recall, in reference to at least MICA, you only pay if the claim is pursued successfully. If that's the case now, evidently you're doing a sort of a contingent liability assessment then, and using that as a basis for increase in the actual cost to the hospitals, to the physicians that are covered. Is that approximately true?
The cases that have not been paid, maybe I can give you some numbers on that if you'd hold on for just about 2 seconds here. We have, Representative Furness, total paid loss to date, and the to date is valued as of 3/31/1988, of around $16.3 million. We also have, as of that same date, what we call outstanding reserves, which you may have termed contingent liability, of about $10.9 million, if that helps answer your question. And certainly those are reserves based upon our estimations of what kind of future costs those claims will hold as a liability to MICA.
Now, let me make sure, Ms. Chris, Mr. Chairman, you paid claims to the tune of $16.3 billion?
Those are paid claims from the inception of MICA to 3/31 of 1988. Yes, correct.
Now, that's covering what period of time?
Let's see. MICA's inception was July 1st of 1976 through 3/31, March 31st of 1988.
Do you have the corresponding amount of premiums collected during this period of time also?
Yes, I do. If, again, you'd hold on for just about 2 seconds. Written premium, Representative Furness, through the end of 1987 was about $29.1 million.
Okay, one last question, Mr. Chairman, I will conclude. Mrs. Pierce, with the Supreme Court decision of Jackson versus Powers, will this case have an impact on hospital liability rates? And if so, will Senate Bill 4621 correct this problem?
Representative Furness, I believe that it will have an impact on hospital liability rates in that what we currently have at this point in time, to give an example, since MICA's inception, we've had 712 files opened. Of those 712 files, approximately 76 of them were physician-oriented files and 24% of them hospital-oriented files. And the premium, of course, is based upon our loss experience, our claims experience. The physicians have been paying premiums based upon that loss percentage, and the hospitals have also. And I would suggest that due to the Jackson versus Powers case, there's going to be a redistribution of premium. And I can't tell you exactly what that redistribution will be, but I can tell you that there will be one. We are currently at MICA charging hospitals that have uninsured physicians on staff 25% of that physician's classification rate to the hospital for their apparent liability as regards that particular uninsured physician. The preliminary studies that I received from the actuary just yesterday, that's David Bickerstaff from Milliman and Robertson, suggest that that charge will at least double. And those are preliminary, and we're still working on coming up with actual figures. So for those hospitals that have uninsured physicians, they can expect to pay more. I'm not sure what the impact will be exactly on the hospitals as regarding their own premium for their own exposure. I would, in reaction to your second question, suggest that the Senate Bill 461 will return us to a pre-Jackson versus Powers status.
Maybe just one last point of clarification. You mentioned there would be a redistribution of premium. Could you just clarify that just a little bit more? What specifically you're speaking of and how that redistribution is perceived, as you said?
Well, we insure both hospitals and physicians. And as such, the malpractice premium that we collect is the best way we can possibly put it is that we're kind of a vehicle for collection to pay off claims in the future. We collect a pot of money to pay off those claims. Part of that pot is paid by physicians' premiums, and part of that pot is paid by hospital premiums. I guess what I'm suggesting here, Representative Furness, is that that pot will be divided differently if we continue to have court cases following what has been considered now to be case law in the Jackson versus Powers.
So basically you're saying then that the distribution is to be heavier towards the hospitals?
Correct.
Than a physician. Very good. I thank you for your response. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Representative Copeland.
Thank you, Representative Copeland. What percentage of your funds available are your premiums are laid off in reinsurance?
The reinsurance cost, Representative Copeland, I think that laid off is probably a good term, because what we do, in fact, is pay a premium that is more of a fund, a pass-through vehicle. Approximately, our premium in 1987 was around $1 million, to be exact, about $1.1 million. So of our written premium, which was $6.9 million in 1987, about $1 million of that went to reinsurance. We are reinsured for a per occurrence of anything above $250,000. We also have an aggregate of $1 million. So the actual amount laid off to reinsurance is something where we are absorbing a good part of that.
What is the current status of the fund that, let's see which fund is that, the medical malpractice loan fund that DCED had, that's within 2188-210. Do you still have access to that loan fund in the Commerce and Economic Development?
Yes, Representative Copeland, we still have access to that fund. It has been paid back. I think the outstanding amount that we have drawn down on the fund is right around $4.2 million. So there is, that would leave $1.8 million available. That is something that we have to request from the legislature.
If at some time, would it be better for VICA to continue operating the way they are, or for us to build up that loan fund again, or to make it more of a revolving fund?
Well, it is a revolving fund at the moment, Representative Kopanen. I would...
With easier access.
Easier access to the fund. Yes, I think that that is something that we could take a look at. We've we did come to the legislature a couple of years ago and asked to draw down on that. We capitalized with $3 million and returned to the legislature in 1986 and asked for another $2 million. And we do repay that, the repayment of the second portion of the second $2 million is based upon our policyholder surplus at the end of the year, so we do have to pay that back based upon that. The interest on the loan, of course, is paid back annually, and we do that as part of our business. I mean, that's incorporated in our structure of our investment policy.
Well, thank you. If you would look at the MICA statute itself, as well as the malpractice loan fund statute, if you have any recommendations that would help the problem. I was, of course, even then in labor and commerce, is why I remember that when you came for the money, and hopefully we can assist in making the MICA a little bit more stable or able to deal with these loans.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks, Mary. Can we go to Fairbanks, Wally Cox, George McKee, and then to Petersburg for Tom Wood?
Mr. Chairman, committee members, I'm Wally Cox, president of the Greater Fairbanks Chamber of Commerce. And representing our 821 individual and business members, we join the U.S. Chamber of Commerce and the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce in encouraging tort reform. I'd like to restate our unified resolve in support of Senate Bill 211, Senate Bill 461. The dramatic escalation of premiums is very damaging, and only damage further the state of the economy. All costs are passed on to consumers by surviving businesses. Recovery, when it comes, needs a scaled-down economic base. In our position paper regarding tort reform, we felt that there were a number of things that must occur. Cap non-economic awards, mandate structured settlement, disclose collateral income sources, establish a sliding scale of attorneys' contingency, modify joint and several liability, require itemization of all jury awards, abolish Rule 82, modify judgment interest, revise wrongful death statute, limit recovery of punitive damages, modify statute limitations, require an affidavit of merit, eliminate the requirement to show special damages, permit award of attorney's fees and payment of reasonable expenses from parties making untrue allegations without reasonable cause. Amended bills appear to do that. Cases of civil liability, responsibility is always determined. Fair liability is fair. Unbridled judgments are irresponsible. Another phenomenon that's a sad commentary in dealing with our fellow man is that of an erosion of basic values, there exists a suit mentality. Citizens of Alaska cannot afford continued deep pocket judgments. We encourage the legislature to pass these two bills. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. George McKee and then Tom Wood.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I handle the risk management functions for the Fairbanks North Star Borough. and I'm here to represent that organization and Mayor Juanita Helms, and urging you to pass the Senate Bill 211. We feel that it will bring a measure of, or assist in bringing a measure of stability to the insurance market, which in fact will be beneficial to local government. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Tom Wood in Petersburg, and then back to Anchorage for Michael Newman.
My name is Tom Wood. I'm a family physician in Petersburg, Alaska. I first came to Alaska as a child in 1947, and I've been a physician here since 1976. I've been a MICA insured since 1976. For the benefit of one of your previous witnesses, I'm also an environmentalist and a past board member of SEAC and a member of the American Civil Liberties Union, and I understand the value of litigation for social good, but I've also seen the misuse of litigation by some of these organizations. I've never been sued myself. I believe I'm a conscientious physician because of my ethics, not because of a liability gun held to my head. But the liability climate creates a great deal of stress for me. I think about it every single day. And I'm on the verge of stopping my liability insurance, which I think will probably increase my stress every day. I also consider dropping out of medical practice and going into some other field because of this constant stress. What I'm looking for is predictability and fairness. I understand that premiums may not drop, but I think that the increased sense of fairness from the passage of SB 211 would help all of us, both consumer and provider. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Doctor. I'd like to go to Michael Newman in Anchorage, and then Ross Brendanell.
Thank you. My name is Michael Newman, and I'm an orthopedic surgeon in private practice in Anchorage, and have been here since 1976. Over the years, the cost of my medical malpractice insurance has risen to the point where it now costs me between $450 to $500 for each and every operation that I do. This cost is, of course, passed along as a direct patient charge. Additionally, I estimate that between 30 and 40% of all the x-rays and lab tests that I order are for defensive purposes only, and I feel that my practice is typical of those orthopedists practicing here in Anchorage. In a time when all responsible people are working towards cost containment in the medical field, spiraling medical malpractice premiums are in fact forcing increased medical costs. Also to be considered are the intangible costs of needed treatment which is withheld. For example, my practice is limited to the spine, which is a very high-risk area. Because of the hostile legal environment alluded to by the previous speaker and which you're well aware of, there are certain procedures which I decline to do. These patients then must live with their problem, or I refer them to Seattle or Los Angeles for treatment, as there are no other surgeons in Alaska who will do these procedures either. For these and other reasons, I strongly urge you to pass Senate Bill 211 and 461 and to expand and improve on the tort reform legislation in the future. I would like to add briefly, in response to the claim that the insurance crisis is not claims related, that malpractice claims when I first came to Anchorage were an uncommon occurrence. Yet I know this year of 8 new cases alone among 23 orthopedists in Anchorage, and I'm sure I don't know all the new cases that have come up this year. I thank you for your efforts and strongly again urge your passage of Senate Bill 211 and 461. Thank you.
Thank you, Doctor. Could we go on to Mr. Brudenell and then Howard Thomas?
Thank you, gentlemen. Good evening. My hat's off to you for working so late tonight. I'm a small businessman who has had a dramatically increased... I'm sorry, my name's Ross Brudenell. I appreciate your pronunciation a moment ago, sir.
Got it, right.
As I said, I'm a small businessman who's had a dramatically increased incidence of liability civil actions against my business since 1980. This is in contrast to my previous experience since about 1972 or 73, where I never saw that happen. My legal defense costs and settlement costs have steadily driven the cost of my product far beyond what I think is a rational inflation-related increase. I believe, in fact, that the existence of my business and my livelihood are threatened by this dramatically increased flow of money away from my business, out of my business. It's my impression, a very distinct impression, particularly tonight, that the opposition to changing civil liability law in Alaska, for some reason, is centered in the legal community. And I mean to witness the statement made by Ms. Horton a time ago this evening. In brief, I speak in support of Bills 211 and 461. I wonder how really altruistic is the motivation of our legal community in opposition to these bills in our society. I know you men have a key role in moving these bills through committee to your full body. I would urge you to move these bills through your committees as quickly as possible and present them favorably to your entire legislative body. Thank you.
Thank you, sir.
Larry
Thomas and then Barbara Collins. Representative Boucher has a question for you. He wants to know what kind of small business
Ross, what type of small business do you have?
Well, maybe I should ask you if you have a guess.
Are you a dynamiter?
No, sir. I'm an orthopedic surgeon, too.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Can we go on to Howard Thomas and then Barbara Collins?
Thank you. Thank you, Chairman Donnelly. My name is Howard Thomas. I'm a professional engineer and president of the Anchorage branch of the American Society of Civil Engineers. The organization represents some 600 civil engineers in South Central Alaska and some 900 statewide. ASCE would like to express its strong support for SB 211. We passed a resolution in support of the bill last week, and copies of this resolution have been sent to the appropriate legislative committee chairman. Thank you very much for the opportunity to testify in support of SB 211.
Thank you, sir. Barbara Collins and Jerry Coles.
Thank you. This is Barbara Collins. I'm here representing the Alaska Public Interest Research Group. In March of 1986, the Insurance Information Institute announced a $6.5 million ad campaign designed to convey the idea that America was in the midst of a lawsuit crisis. This alleged lawsuit crisis has a couple of different components, high awards and product liability and malpractice cases and a alleged litigation explosion. It was claimed that we live in the most litigious society in the world. The testimony I heard yesterday at the hearing of this committee certainly reflects the success that this campaign has had with business professionals who are trying to cope with and find answers to the very real insurance crisis we have all been affected by. The lawsuit crisis was referred to over and over again by people testifying in favor of 211 and 461. I've been doing a great deal of research for ACFERG on insurance issues, and I'd like to point out some of the things that I've learned about the lawsuit crisis. First of all, on high awards, from the jury verdict research group, number one, the growth in median initial medical malpractice awards between 1975 and 1984 was less than the rise in inflation. For product liability cases, the growth rate for the median initial award slightly exceeded the inflation rate for the same period. The second finding, from 1972 to 1986, there had been 1,642 awards of more than $1 million. For a nation of well over 200 million people, that hardly seems excessive. Also, in over two-thirds of the cases, the awards were made for injuries of permanent paralysis, brain damage, amputations, and death. From the RAND Corporation Institute for Civil Justice, after tracking tort actions since 1960 in San Francisco and in Cook County, Illinois, which includes Chicago, they found that the median initial award when adjusted for inflation stayed virtually level. Now on the litigation explosion. From the National Center for State Courts, 14 states that kept track of tort filings during the period of 78 to 1984, there was a 10% increase in filings. The population growth for those states at the same time was 8%. From the Government Accounting Office, it recently released a study on product liability filings in federal court.
The conclusion was that there had indeed been an increase in filings from 1975 to 1985. But to quote the report, it was neither rapidly accelerating nor explosive. In fact, a significant part of the growth was concentrated on one product, asbestos, and to a lesser degree on the Dalkin Shield and Bendectin filings. From ACPIRG, here in Alaska, from 1977 to 1987, the percentage of total Superior Court filings that civil damage suits have accounted for has risen by 2.25%, from 6.25% in 1977 to 8.5% in 1987. I'd like to qualify that data by saying that determining whether society has become excessively litigious should not rest with counting the number of suits that have been filed. Factors such as expansions in the economy, in population, in the products that are available, and even in population categories affect the number of filings. And the number of filings doesn't tell us whether particular suits are frivolous or substantive. Also, the filings tell us nothing about the extent to which the goal of providing compensation for wrongful injuries and deterring unsafe practices is being met by the current system. And they certainly tell us nothing about whether that goal can be met by the measures proposed in SB 211. That said, I would still like to make the point that the studies I have seen do not make a case for any kind of lawsuit crisis which the Alaska State Legislature should feel compelled to address. Okay, I would agree with the testimony I heard yesterday that the cost and availability of liability insurance is adversely affecting everyone in the state. ACPIRG is particularly concerned about the problems hospitals and medical professionals are facing with malpractice insurance. These problems are a threat to the continued provision of quality health care throughout the state. However, I must take issue with the sentiments expressed yesterday by several people testifying in favor of 211 and 461. They stated that the problems are caused solely by disgruntled patients who sue hospitals and doctors at the slightest provocation or whenever a medical procedure is not successful. I heard no data whatsoever, though, to substantiate this claim. Malpractice does exist, and people who have been harmed by it should have the right to seek compensation. Therefore, I must conclude. I realize your time is short, and I want to say that ACPIRG does not support 211 nor 461. We haven't seen any substantiation of real benefit. We agree with the previous testimony you've heard from the Older Alaskans Commission and from the Women's Lobby about the negative impact that caps on non-economic damages will have, that the forcing of periodic payments will have. We're also concerned about the joint and several liability section. We certainly agree that we need more reporting requirements, and we support that section of the bill wholeheartedly. I am concerned when I hear Paul Roller say that it's going to take $150,000 to produce one of the reports that are being required. That amounts to almost 10% of the Division of Insurance's annual budget, as far as I, from what I understand. I think that the Division of Insurance budget is definitely going to have to be increased. It is the third largest revenue-producing entity in this state, and the under the concept of new concept of the revenues that an entity brings in being reflected in their budget, we should definitely be increasing their budget for greater enforcement and to help them collect the data that we need to make real decisions based on real data about where we should be going with insurance in this state. I had a couple of other comments, but I'm going to close, and unless you have some questions.
I see no questions from the committee. Thank you very much for your testimony.
You're welcome.
Okay, Jerry Coles and Dorothy Fulton.
I'm Jerry Coles, a physician in Anchorage, Alaska, in the practice of urology. I've lived in Alaska for the last 17 years. I'd like to speak in favor of Senate Bill 211 and 461. I think these bills are reasonable, fair, and in the case of Senate Bill 211, overdue measures. I think that these measures will cost the state little or nothing. The legislature, however, however, can decrease expenses of individuals, small and large businesses in this state, by hundreds of thousands of dollars per year with these measures. The district attorney suit by several states, I feel, is just a legal smokescreen. It is ridiculous to think that the insurance companies are trying to price themselves out of business. In the medical field, the two primary Alaska insurers operate at cost only, and in fact, one insurer has been subsidizing the Alaska physicians through California physicians. In California, tort reform has worked. Liability insurance costs have been reduced significantly. And I feel there's no question that good legislation in this state will do the same. I ask that you support and pass out of committee as soon as possible these two bills. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Dorothy Fulton and Dick Towell.
We're going to skip Dorothy and go to the